Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jap Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we want to start off the show. I'd like to talk about Biden's town hall meeting last night, which I watched and took notes on very copiously here, to try to sense what's going on between the lines. It's a good opportunity to sense what are some of the problems of Biden's strategy at the moment, and is it really breaking down? If so, it would be interesting that only 9 months after coming into the office, his whole strategy for the economy and the country is beginning to unravel. Let's jump in and look at some of the things he said, and what do they really reveal. After this, I want to talk about inflation. What's really happening with prices, and why do we have now what the talking heads and economists are admitting will be chronic supply-driven inflation. In other words, this is not going away. Inflation officially in the 12 prior months to September was 5.4%. That's the consumer price index. Well, that's pretty steep, 5.5%. But now they're saying it's going to continue for quite some time here, you know, at least 9 months into the middle of next year. Well, it will be certainly at least another 5%. And that means inflation at 10% plus in the last 12, 18 months has reduced the spending power of wages by that much. In other words, it's a 10% wage cut. Your money, your wages won't buy as much as they did before. And anybody going to the grocery store or the gas station knows exactly what I'm talking about. So we can expect significant inflation going forward and further reduction of wages in real terms. So we need to understand this inflation thing and why the Fed and the government has got it so wrong. And then if we have time, I want to conclude and make some comments on what's going on in China, specifically in the property markets in China, you know, housing and commercial real estate, which is really in a big trouble right now with defaults that are pending very soon, and contagion that's beginning to appear in China and will certainly then appear globally as well. Are we at the very early stage of another subprime mortgage-like financial instability event? Bears watching. Can go either way. We need to understand that and watch that closely, which I have been. So I want to, if we have time, talk about that. But that topic is going to continue to come up on shows as I watch that closely going forward. Okay, let's go back to Biden's town hall and talk about, of course, at the crux of that town hall meeting, the charade going on with negotiations within the Democratic Party with their two bete noire senators there, Manchin and Sinema. It was very revealing, I thought, when Biden was asked about the climate change provisions in his Build Back Better bill, specifically about getting spending $150 billion to get the corporations and power companies to drop its oil and coal-driven plants. You know, that fight has been going on since Obama, well, in the Obama administration, to get these companies that produce power, particularly in the East, using coal and oil, and to convert to natural gas and alternative energies. Well, you know, in the Build Back Better bill, that $3.5 trillion, which is now half of what it was, in that bill called for $150 billion to upgrade the electricity grid in this country, specifically for moving towards alternative energies. And in the context of that, Biden mentioned part of the problem with Manchin was that very, very proposal, because it had penalties, of course, on coal companies and on companies incentives for other companies to convert from coal. And of course, Joe Manchin is a coal investor. And Joe Manchin, as part of coming on board with Biden, has said, no, you got to get rid of that. Now, that makes a lot of, sense in the sense that, coal state, by the way, it's kind of a fiction that so many jobs will be lost in West Virginia. Only 3% of all the jobs in West Virginia are coal related. Only 3% now. Yeah. So, it's not to protect coal industry jobs that Manchin has taken on this position. It's to protect his investments and his buddies who put the money up for him to run for office, coal companies. That's what this is really about, Manchin. Now, I haven't got to the most important point here, and that is Biden let it slip. You have to listen very closely, but he let it slip that proposal of $150 billion to convert to non-coal sources is now going to be not just taken out, it's going to be used, according to Biden, to provide tax cuts for coal and energy and fossil fuel companies. In other words, they're not just taking out the spending on alternative energy, they're going to give that money in tax cuts to the fossil fuel companies and other corporations too. That's the deal that he struck with Manchin. Yeah, $150 billion more. As if they needed more tax cuts after Trump's $4.5 trillion in 2018. Yeah, I'm going to give more tax cuts here. That's an energy policy, you see? That's an energy policy. Now, the other thing that Biden let slip fairly quickly, if you didn't listen to it, it would have passed you by, was his discussion about Sinema. Kyrsten Sinema, the senator from Arizona, he all but admitted that the reason why Sinema is not on board at this time is very simple. It's tax cuts and tax hikes. It's the tax issue to spend to fund the bill, Build Back Better, reconciliation bill, same thing, to fund it. Biden has proposed raising corporate tax rates from the current 20% to 26%. It was 35% before Trump. Trump cut it to 20% or 21%. From 35 to 21%, what a massive corporate tax cut that was. Well, Biden, from the very beginning, has said, I'm only going to raise it to 26%. And then he was going to take back some individual tax cuts for folks who are earning over $400,000 a year. Just tax the rich. Those are the two ways he's going to pay for this bill, with tax hikes. Well, Sinema says no tax hikes, not on corporations, not even back to the token 26%, and not on the rich over $400,000 a year. That's her issue. That's the only thing, apparently, that she's demanding. No tax hikes. In other words, don't reverse the Trump tax cuts. He let it slip, Biden did, that was the issue with her. It's interesting to watch how both Manchin and Sinema have double teamed in this whole effort to drive down the Build Back Better bill from $3.5 trillion down to, well, I think this morning or last night, Biden says get used to $1.9 trillion. Now, I've been predicting months ago, at least 3 months ago, that this thing would be reduced from $3.5 trillion to $1.8 trillion. I said that months ago. You know, check out my blog and my articles. You know, if you don't follow me on Twitter, do that, and you'll see that since the middle of the summer, I've been saying, no, this thing's going down to 1.8%, or maybe lower. Why did I say that? All you had to do was see what happened with the infrastructure bill passed last March to know what they were going to do with the Build Back Better bill. You know, stepping back, let's get a little history of this. You know, Biden runs for election trying to keep the progressives tied into the Democratic Party, the Sanders folks, right? By agreeing to their social programs. You know, I will go for minimum wage hike. I will go for expanding Medicare and expanding Obamacare. I will go for paid leave for 12 weeks so that, you know, we at least start to bridge the gap with other countries, capitalist countries that provide paid leave of months. I will agree to some paid leave. I will agree to kindergarten education for kids and free community college. You know, I will agree to a massive climate change investment program, et cetera, et cetera. That's the Build Back Better bill. When he comes into office, though, in January, what's the first thing? The very first thing that Biden did, within a week, I think it was, he met with CEOs of big corporations. And the next day he comes out of there and he says, oh, we're not going to raise the minimum wage. That's off the table. Now, if he had raised the minimum wage $15, it would have provided $400 billion of stimulus, ongoing stimulus this year. Right? And you wouldn't have the problem of workers refusing to come back to work for $7.25 an hour, millions of them. You know, that problem would have been solved. Yeah. So immediately he starts reneging on the Sanders program that he agreed to embrace during an election. Then the next step was last March, after they had passed the Emergency American Rescue Plan, which is just a mitigation, buy some time, you see. Now the real stimulus was to be negotiated, and that was the infrastructure bill and the Build Back Better bill. But the infrastructure bill initially was like $2.4 trillion. Yeah. And that included a lot of climate investment and climate change proposals and some social programs, social infrastructure, human infrastructure. But Biden and the corporate wing of the Democratic Party convinced Sanders to break out the two bills. Let's go past the infrastructure bill first. And Bernie fell for it and said, okay, so long as you pass them both at the same time. And Pelosi supported that. So that became the strategy in March. And they went on and they passed a traditional infrastructure bill, you know, highways and roads and stuff, ports and stuff like that. Not $2.3 trillion. They claimed it was $1.1 trillion. It wasn't really $1.1 trillion. It was $550 billion of new spending. They threw in other programs they already supported and had money for and to say, oh, it's $1.1 trillion. Well, that's still far away from $2.3 trillion and even farther away from $550 billion. The important point is they reduced that bill, the infrastructure bill, by dumping off the human infrastructure elements, you know, and reducing it to $550 billion so they would not have to raise taxes. That bill is paid for with smoke and mirrors, moving the money around from different pots in the government. No tax hikes on that, you see. No reversal of Trump tax cuts. No corporate tax increase. You know, no wealthy tax increase to pay for the infrastructure bill, $550 billion. and they dump the human infrastructure into another pot, which they then called the $3.5 trillion Build Back Better bill, or sometimes referred to as the reconciliation bill. And they promised Sanders and the progressives, we will not pass one without the other. In other words, we will have to get the infrastructure passed and get the Senate to go ahead and pass the Build Back Better bill at the same time. Then you can vote on it in the House. And Pelosi said, okay. Except now, several weeks ago, Pelosi signaled, well, we're going to vote on the infrastructure bill first. Well, that caused a little bit of a revolt there among the Sanders Progressive Caucus group in the House, and she backed off of that. But that's what they're going to do, you see. That was their plan all along. You break out the infrastructure, you get some Republican votes, you pass that, and then the Build Back Better bill is just floundering out there with no leverage. And Pelosi is abandoning that, and they've already decided to abandon that. But first, they got to drive down the spending in the Build Back Better bill the same way they did it with the infrastructure bill last March. That's what's been going on. And that's why I predicted that it would be slashed to $1.8 trillion or lower, because the whole thing is about the tax hikes, you see. Cinema. It's about the tax hikes. If you don't cut the spending down, you have to raise taxes. If you cut the spending down, you don't have to raise taxes. Exactly what they did with the infrastructure bill. They're trying to do that with the Build Back Better bill, the social spending bill, and climate change bill. By the way, the infrastructure bill only provides for $15 billion in infrastructure investment out of a $1.1 trillion for climate. There's nothing in there of any import with regard to climate change investments. The proposals are there in the Build Back Better bill, the $450 billion of it, $150 billion of which is this electric grid conversion to get away from fossil fuels, which, as I said at the beginning, Manchin does not want, and which Manchin is gotten Biden to agree to turn into $150 billion tax cuts for fossil fuel industry. Yeah. So what we are at is seeing a repeat of what happened to the infrastructure bill in this Build Back Better bill. Slash and burn, cut it, slash it, reduce it, and then figure out how you move the money around, smoke and mirrors, phony financing, so you don't have to raise the tax hikes on corporations and wealthy individuals. Cinema. You know, Cinema and Manchin are very cleverly double-teaming Sanders and the progressives here. And I think some of the progressives don't even know what's going on. And, of course, the progressives are step-by-step in retreat, concession, concession. And Biden's now in the mix, in the final 11th hour here, helping that happen. That's where we are, you see. I don't even think the $1.8 trillion is going to hold, because I don't think they can come up with enough smoke and mirrors not to raise taxes to get to a $1.8 trillion. You know, Manchin negotiated it down to the 1.9, officially 1.8, but now Sinema's on the scene and she's getting her bite of the apple. These people are corporate shills. That's who these two are. You know, it's not individuals doing this. It's not Sinema and Manchin. There's a big interest group within the Democratic Party on its central committee, the corporate wing, who are really backing Sinema and Manchin. They don't want the tax cuts of Trump reversed either. They want the tax cuts to remain as much as Mitch McConnell does. That's the problem, Democratic Party, you see. The progressive wing is a minority, and they're crying in the wilderness, and they are lost. And they are getting driven back further and further and further. You watch. This thing's going to come out a minimalist bill, if it occurs. It could still collapse, I think. A minimalist bill. And the Democrats will say, well, we got all we could get. You know, what you guys got to do out there is make sure you elect more of us in 2022 so we can really get the rest. You know, they'll turn it into a mobilizing to elect them campaign. It doesn't matter what you're going to do. Democrats are going to get swamped in the House in November 2022. That's inevitable. It's going to happen. They're going to lose the House. The economy is weak, growing weaker. Inflation is running away, and they have this inadequate stimulus that they're going to agree to. 2022, the economy is going to be in worse shape than it is now, I predict. The Democrats only have like a 6-vote majority in the House. They're going to lose it. Because in the red states, a couple dozen red states, they're gerrymandering like hell, their legislatures, and they're going to at least squeeze out 6 Democrats out of their House seats, at least by the gerrymandering alone, which Biden's doing nothing about. Yeah. So they're toast come 2022. I don't know about the Senate. I haven't made an assessment of seats in the Senate, whether they could hold on the majority there, but it won't matter because they'll lose the House. Weak economy. How weak is the economy, by the way? Well, we had a 6.7 quarter-on-quarter increase in GDP in the second quarter of this year, and that was April to June, as the economy reopened, and we had some stimulus from the American Rescue Plan. So the economy reopened, but the economy has since fallen back significantly. The Atlanta Federal Reserve District has this shadow GDP forecast. And they forecasted that the third quarter U.S. GDP, that's July through September, is going to be only 1.3%. In other words, from 6.7%, we're slowing down to 1.3% growth in the third quarter. GDP figures preliminary will come out pretty soon. 1.3%, that's nothing. And we're running into inflation? And workers aren't returning to work? And we have these big supply chain problems that are impacting production? And the Fed is raising interest rates now starting in November? And the global economy is slowing in China, in Europe, and elsewhere? Don't tell me we're going to see a boost of growth. In consumer spending, by the way, and consumer sentiment, in retail sales is in trouble. We can see that in the statistics already in the third quarter. The U.S. economy is not rebounding. It is relapsing. We had the rebound in the spring and summer, and now we got a relapse going on. In other words, growth slowing down dramatically once again. Exactly what happened last year. We had a rebound as they tried to open the economy in the third quarter. GDP quarter-to-quarter growth was 7.4%. That collapsed to 1.1% at the end of last year. We got a similar trajectory underway. Oh, this time, you know, they're opening more because they got the vaccine. Oh, but this time we got bad inflation, supply-driven inflation, which really cuts into real spending, real consumer spending. So there are pluses, but there are minuses as well this time around. And we got a repeat. We have a partial rebound followed by a relapse. Partial rebound followed by a relapse. That describes what I've called the Great Recession, always. Short, shallow recoveries followed by relapses, which may just be much slower growth. It may be stagnant growth. In some cases, in the weakest links in other areas of the world, it could be another double-dip recession. That's what's going on. It's another great recession that I had predicted way back in March 2020 would be the trajectory. And in the face of that, they're driving down the stimulus that they desperately need to minimal levels, which is what's occurring now in the negotiations. Okay. Biden also talked in his town hall about this problem of getting workers back to work. And he says, oh, it was the low wages, right? And that's what's keeping people from going back to work. And by the way, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence wherever companies have agreed to really boost the low wages, everyone's come back to work, you see. Yeah. Come on, Joe. If you had raised the minimum wage and didn't listen to your corporate buddies back there in February and raised the minimum wage as you promised during the election, we would not have this problem of people refusing to come back to ridiculously low wages. They would have come back already. So, Joe, you have responsibility here for why people aren't coming back to work. Oh, and he talked, Biden talked about, oh, we kind of have a broken spirit and attitude and anxiety by workers. Yeah, he used the word broken spirit. You know, it reminds me of Jimmy Carter way back in, what was it, 78, 79, said, oh, the country has a malaise, is suffering from a malaise. Well, here it is again, a broken spirit. Yeah, the same explanation. He then, Biden, talked about the supply chain problem. If you know, he had a press conference about a week ago saying, oh, what he was going to do was open up the Los Angeles ports, you know, because we have all these ships sitting out, you know, in a harbor and they're not unloading. So what he's going to do, he's going to try to get the ports. And there's two ports down there in L.A., by the way. There's the Long Beach, which is the real port, the big one. And then there's the little port called Los Angeles Port. Los Angeles has a lot to do with, you know, cruise ships and so forth. You know, the big port is Long Beach. And, he says, I'm going to require them to go 24/7. Well, what he did tell you was that the big port, Long Beach, was already on 24/7. So he's just adding the small Los Angeles port, you know, to 24/7 operations. The problem is not just 24/7. The problem is a lot of workers aren't coming back. Working the ships, right? The sailors, working the docks, you know, the longshoremen. And the warehouse and truckers, you know, truckers got to pick up that stuff and they take it to the inland warehouses, you know, in East L.A., 20, 30 miles away. And from there, it gets shipped out by rail oftentimes to different parts of the country. Well, we got a shortage of truck drivers. We got a shortage of warehouse workers, believe it or not. We got a shortage of all along the supply chain. That's part of the problem. The part of the problem is also not too many ships in the port in L.A., but not enough ships. Well, how do we get that? Well, that's because in Asia, the ships are being used in intra-Asia trade and shipping far more. So that's a shortage of getting freighters and ships, container ships, coming to the West Coast. Well, why is that? Well, because during the crisis, the shipping companies took big losses and they mothballed their ships and the workers went away. The sailors and people working in different parts of the supply chain, they went away. and they mothballed them. Well, all of a sudden, the economy opens up, and they can't get these ships back in service fast enough. Plus, as I said, a lot of them are diverted to inter-Asia trade. That's why we got a shortage of ships. You know, some of the big retailers, I've heard Target, Walmart, are bypassing the normal process of renting containers, and they're renting entire ships to bring their containers of goods over. The cost of containers have gone up. They used to be about $1,500 a container. Some containers are $5,000 and $10,000 now. Well, at that high cost, businesses aren't even contracting for it. They can't make a profit. I'm talking about the middlemen, the shippers who lease the containers. You see, it's a very complex supply chain problem. But none of this would exist. None of this if during the 80s, 90s, and aughts, U.S. companies hadn't moved so much of their manufacturing offshore. None of this would exist. You know, we saw during COVID all these problems with personal protective equipment and intubators and ventilators and so forth. That's because, and testing kits and problems, that's because they moved it all offshore to Asia. That's why we had such shortages. But is Biden doing anything about forcing these companies back to the U.S.? No, nothing. Trump either. Of course, Biden's not doing anything really different from Trump in that regard. They moved offshore and it'll let them stay there. When we have another pandemic, we're going to see even worse problem because of offshoring. You see, none of this would exist, supply shortages, if we hadn't given big tax incentives and other incentives for U.S. corporations to move offshore, which they have in the last 30 years. Yeah. So the problem with inflation is a supply-side inflation problem. It's not a question of demand. Yeah, demand is picked up as people have gone back to work, but the demand is picked up for services, not for durable goods, not for stuff that they bring over on containers on ships. That's not where the demand has increased. In fact, the demand has declined because consumers know they can't get certain things, so they're not even demanding them. Cars, new cars are an example there, right? Everything in which you have semiconductor chips, pretty much. Because there's a shortage of semiconductor chips. Why? Oh, because they closed down the semiconductor, the chip factories during COVID. And now they're trying to ramp them up again. A lot of this cheap semiconductors come from Taiwan and other parts in Asia. So, you know, there's a shortage. There's a shortage. But the demand is not rising for goods that are impacted by the supply chain problems. No, it's rising, or was, for non-goods, in other words, services. So it's not a demand-driven. It's not a demand-driven problem. It's a supply problem. It's a global supply problem, and it's a supply problem domestically as well, because a lot of U.S. companies just cut their inventories of goods to the bone. And now they're trying to ramp it up once again. Well, it's easier to ramp up domestic production than it is international, global production offshore. But still, there's a problem of inventories. And to some extent, businesses don't want to build inventories because they're not so damn sure that this recovery is sustainable either. So, you know, they're not going to load up on stuff unless there is a clear demand for it. You know, they're going to buy more stuff, invest more, but they're going to do it cautiously. And the same thing, they're going to bring back workers cautiously. You know, we keep hearing that, oh, it's the workers not wanting to go back to work, and that's part of it. But it's also businesses not wanting to really bring them all back to work at full hours that they had before. They're testing the businesses and services industry in particular, testing the waters to see, you know, how much they really need in terms of jobs. And they're often bringing people back at fewer hours of work. And that's another reason why workers don't want to come back, fewer hours of work in the service sectors. And they're tired of being jerked around with schedules and low pay and no guaranteed hours and no benefits, you know. They're tired of that. Oh, but Biden calls that a broken spirit, right? And he says, oh, you know, what I'm trying to do here in the ports is to make them more efficient and so forth. And he was asked, by the way, by the CNN interviewer, Anderson, there last night in the town hall meeting, you know, would you call in the National Guard to the ports? Everybody said, yes, if I have to. Yeah, watch what the longshore workers do when you bring the National Guard to take their jobs. Yeah. And he said, if I need to, you know, I'll bring in National Guard to boost up the trucking. Come on. National Guard driving these 18-wheelers, huh, with containers on them? You think they're going to do that? You don't just jump in a cab of an 18-wheeler and drive it. No, no, no. Takes a lot of skill. Well, you're not going to have the National Guard take over the trucking industry. No way. But that's what he said he would do. Well, that's just bullshit, right? Okay. He was asked, you know, about inflation here and the oil side, the problem with inflation, crude oil, you know, imports. Wait a minute. I thought we weren't dependent on oil imports from Saudi Arabia anymore. You know, we produce in the U.S. more oil than the Saudis do. Yeah, we produce more oil than the Saudis do. So why is this talk about OPEC and the Saudis? He's gonna talk to them to get the price of oil down. First of all, they're not going to reduce the price of oil. They've been trying for 2 years now to get the price up. They're not about to listen to the Saudis and OPEC and the Russians. They're not about to reduce the price of oil again. Now, that's just a way of deflecting the cause from the U.S. oil companies, you know? That shut down, you know, a lot of their drilling, and now, you know, very cautiously they're trying to increase the drilling, but they're not going gangbusters to do it either. They like the idea that there's a shortage because they can jack up their prices, which they've done for gasoline and getting to work. And you watch this winter, home heating prices are going to double. You think you're being raped by the electric companies now, you know, you wait in another month or two, what happens to home heating and natural gas prices this winter on top of it, you know, the auto gas price rises, on top of the food price rises going on. On top of the supply chain driving up prices for all kinds of different goods, on top of the rent prices that are rising at a double digit rate now. Yeah, across the board, it's already far more than 5.4%, folks. Don't believe the figures from the Fed that it's like 3.5%. No working class household believes that they're prices are rising 3.5%. Hell, their food prices alone are at least double or triple that, right? Okay, so, you know, his solution, Biden's solution to the supply chain problem is no solution at all, right? And then he talked about voting rights, right? And, of course, that's tied in with the filibuster. You know, filibuster is preventing voting reform. He can't get his voting rights bill through Congress. Again, because of the cinemas and the others, they're blocking it. And he was asked by, the interviewer last night, what would he do about the filibuster? Will he try to get rid of the filibuster? And we got a kind of run around the bush here by Biden, you know, what he would do. But he essentially said, oh, I can't do that now because I'll alienate 3 votes at least from passing my Build Back Better bill. See, he's afraid to take him on. He's not going to get rid of the filibuster. Come on. And if you don't, there's no voting rights reform, period. It's that simple. No voting rights reform. And if there's no voting rights reform, that means the radical right in the red states are running amok now with voter suppression and gerrymandering, you know, are outmaneuvering the Democrats again, who really haven't done anything since before Obama to check gerrymandering or voter suppression, won't do anything about it now, and they're digging their own grave when it comes to 2022, 2024, right? It's a very dire picture for democracy in this country going forward. And we're talking about anxiety. You wait until the 2022 election, then 2024. By the way, polls show that Trump is running neck to neck with Biden now. You know, Biden's support has dropped precipitously. You know, is it the right wing that's abandoning him? No, they were never for him, and Republicans were never for him in the first place. His support, Biden's support, is dropping because his Democratic base is frustrated and greatly disappointed that we're not getting the solutions that were promised, and they're abandoning him. You know, there's talk about Trump saying some of his people don't vote in the next election. Well, that's about don't vote for Republicans that Trump wants to dump and replace with his radical writers. That's what that's about. Yeah. But you're going to see a lot of Bernie and progressive supporters give up on the Democratic Party, too, if they really don't do something about it. And then also on this question of democracy, what do we got? Well, we got this issue of Steve Bannon, right? Right on the inside of all the planning for this January 6th insurrection. By the way, nothing's really happening there either, is it? Almost coming up on a year now, and no one's been prosecuted, right? And Republicans are succeeding in preventing that from going forward because they will reveal that a whole number of sitting Republicans were in on this shit of January 6th. That's why they're so desperately trying to block it, because they know it goes right up to the top. It's not just Trump. Well, Bannon's at the center of that. In fact, there is video recordings of Bannon talking to his base. Video recordings in which he's before January 6th, in which he's predicting what's going to happen on January 6th. They got this guy cold. Yeah. And he could open up a bag of worms for the Republican Party. But he won't testify. He'll want this thing to go to the courts, the Supreme Court. He'll refuse. This is a test case, you see? So, when Biden was asked what's his position on it, he demurred and he said, it's up to my Attorney General Garland. I'm not going to tell him what to do. Signal, signal, you know. They'll make a lot of noise, but they're not going to do a damn thing. And that'll only encourage the radical right. See, we got away with January 6th. We can do it better next time. Okay. And there was some talk about immigration policies. And he finished up talking about China, the threat of China, the technology threat, and the military threat. Right? And he was asked, Biden was asked outright, will you defend Taiwan? And he said, yes, of course we'll defend Taiwan. Well, that's a pretty shaky situation over there now with Taiwan. And now we see the U.S. media beating the drums, you know, talking about China having hypersonic missiles, right? Yeah, well, hypersonic missiles, everyone's got hypersonic missiles. Everyone, meaning Russians, U.S., and China. That's not new. China says, by the way, oh, this was not a hypersonic missile test. This was a space launch, you know? Well, who knows who's lying here? But very clearly, you know, we are about to embark on a new arms race with China. Not good. You know, when you got both sides targeting each other with hypersonic missiles, there is no pre-warning. And if there's a mistake, it evokes an action that can't be called back. Can't even be decided whether to call it back. There's not even enough time to decide. It's like automatic. A mistake means an automatic launch with hypersonic missiles. This isn't just the 11th hour. This is the 11th hour and 58th minutes to Armageddon here with hypersonic weapons. Okay, and the U.S. is rushing headlong in developing that, of course. So that was the Biden town hall. You know, read between the lines and what was discussed. You know, these aren't prepared statements like a press conference, right? This is the chief himself, the president himself, saying things himself and revealing what's really going on, you know, in the negotiations, in the economy, with foreign policy and so forth. Okay, to sum up the inflation, you know, it's a supply side problem, no doubt about it. It's global and it's domestic. It has to do with goods, not with services. And goods are, you know, goods are durable goods is only 8-10% of the total U.S. GDP and economy. It's about 80% of the U.S. economy is services. Now, and the problem with inflation is going to be with us for quite some time, months, and it may get worse. And it's occurring at a time when the economy is slowing, and workers are refusing to, you know, to go back to low-paying jobs. And other issues, the Fed raising interest rates, and you know, some of the stimulus programs that were boosting spending here are dropping like flies. You know, the extra unemployment benefits, the rent assistance, child care comes to an end at the end of the year here. A whole number of provisions are being eliminated that were passed last March with the American Rescue Plan, and nothing is really coming, you know, behind it. The infrastructure bill, which will pass, won't start taking effect until at least mid-late next year. Too late. And this Build Back Better bill is being slashed. We'll see where that comes out. I still think there's a 50-50 chance it won't pass at all. Right. Democrats will say, see, you know. Well, it's kind of hard for the Democrats to point finger at Republicans when the problem's really within the Democratic Party itself. But people will lose, you know, all hope with the Democrats here if they don't pass something, and if the economy really turns bad over the next year. I mean, they're toast here. They're toast. What we see is a real degeneration of the political parties going on right before our eyes. The Republicans are captured by this cultist. You know, that's one of the problems here in the Republican Party. And the Democrat Party can't seem to listen to what the people want because this corporate ring doesn't want to pay more. And we see that on the Democrat side. These two parties are in a slow collapse right before our eyes. You know, 5-10 years from now, we'll see it more clearly. You know, you go back to the founding convention, 1787 Constitutional Convention, and then the debates that followed it to get the new Constitution ratified. I think it was 1791, you know, a couple of years to ratify it. And we had published, what got published were some articles in the press to debate the Constitution that was pending for votes. These came to be known as the Federalist Papers. You know, James Madison and John Hancock, I think, wrote a couple, you know. Most of them written by Alexander Hamilton, the big corporatist, you see. But in that, Madison, who later became president, warned. And by the way, he was in a lot of conversations with Jefferson, who was then ambassador to France. He wasn't around. But they had a lot of conversations. And Madison warned, he said, you know, the problem with the country may be these political parties. We can't have these factions. They call them political factions because they popped up right away. You know, you had a pro-business party led by Hamilton and John Adams and Washington. By the way, they are all big land speculators, every one of them. Yeah, and then we had a more populist party that was Jefferson's party, right? And Madison was part of that. But he warned about the political parties were the bane of democracy. Watch out. If the republic is destroyed, it will be because of these political factions. What a forecast. Yeah, we're seeing it right before our eyes. As these two parties and the party system begins to decay in this country, we see the Republican Party turning into a cult operation, and we see the Democrat Party, you know, unable to respond to the needs of the people, unable because of its corporate wing holding it back. You know, I wrote a book in early 2020 called Neoliberalism, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump. And in the last chapter, I predicted how neoliberal policies could not coexist in the long run with even the limited liberal democracy we had in this country, that they would have to remove some of those democratic rights and reforms in order for neoliberalism to continue on the economic side. And that's what's exactly happening. As neoliberalism gets more aggressive and more virulent, tries to maintain itself, it's chipping away at democracy, both at the grassroots level and at the institution level and the norms level, because it stands in the way. So we have this dual crisis, a political crisis and an economic crisis that's still continuing, you know, in between bouts of where it really gets worse, you know, with the financial crash 2008-09 and now the COVID-driven situation today, overlaid on top of what is an atrophying, a decline in the economic side and the political institutions. What will this produce in the next decade? We will see. We will see. But that's what I was talking about even a year ago. Well, I got another book coming out here probably early next year called The Viral Economy, America's Second Great Recession. Stay tuned for that. Some of the articles I've been writing on my blog, jackrasmus.com, and on my website and interviews, you know, address some of the topics and information We've been talking about it here. So I'll give the audience more information about the viral economy, America's second great recession, here as we get closer to it, publication. But I want to really see what happens here in the fourth quarter of the economy. You know, it's not ready to really conclude that book, because it's a work in progress. The economy is a work in progress, and the policies are a work in progress. We're seeing the collapse of stimulus right before our eyes, right? And we're seeing the continued decay of democracy right before our eyes, and we'll see what happens fourth quarter. But a lot of predictions I made in the Scourge of Neoliberalism are coming true, unfortunately. Okay, in the time left, just a few comments here about China. And at some point, we'll have a full show on what's happening in China and its property markets. But China, you know, has a lot of its growth was propped up on boosting properties, housing and commercial property, buildings and apartments and factories and all that. A lot of its large growth rate the last couple of decades has been on the property-driven side. Well, they've built up the tremendous debt bubble here on the property side. And when you build up debt bubbles in housing, you have bubble crashes in housing. We saw that in the U.S. and other countries here in 2008-9. Is the same thing going on in China now? We have this massive debt buildup. But as I've always said, contrary to some economists, it's not the level of debt that matters. It's the ability to pay the principal and interest on the debt as it comes due that matters. You can add more and more debt to your economy as long as you're increasing the wealth of your economy and the incomes to service that debt. Well, the debt bubble is so large. Are we going to see a collapse of a property financial asset prices? Well, that's happening. Evergrande is a company, big developer, third largest in China, that's about to default, if not already. You know, inevitable will default. The question is, will the default spread to other developers in China? And there's signs that's beginning. And will then the contagion spill over to global property markets? That's what needs to be watched. We're right at the beginning of that process, but I fear it's beginning to look similar, and China's property, Evergrande, and China's property crisis may be the next subprime market-like crisis hitting the global financial economy. Might be. We will see. Bears watching. Follow me on Twitter at drjackrasmus, where I'm, you know, daily talking about that and the latest facts and news about the Evergrande and the China bubble, property bubble, and financial crises and so forth. So follow me there. And also, if you want, follow me. I talk about the Build Back Better, the latest in the negotiations. That's at Dr. Jack Rasmus on Twitter. And then I write the articles, jackrasmus.com, on my blog, and I'll be writing one this week as well about what's going on with the negotiations with the Build Back Better bill. Okay, that's it. We're out of time. I'm out of here. Next week.